Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 20th of May. Our guests this hour have written a book, and it's an important book, I believe, Fixing Failed States, A Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World. They write that today between 40 and 60 nations, home to over a billion people, have either collapsed or are teetering on the brink of failure. The world's worst problems, terrorism, drugs, human trafficking, absolute poverty, ethnic conflict, disease, genocide, originate in such states, and the international community has devoted billions of dollars to solving the problem, and yet by and large the effort has not succeeded. Our guests have taken an active part in the effort to save failed states for many years, serving as World Bank officials, advisors to the UN, and high-level participants in the new government of Afghanistan. And they describe the issue, offering an on-the-ground picture of why past efforts have not worked and advancing a groundbreaking new solution to this most pressing of global crises. Military force, they write, while certainly necessary on occasion, cannot solve the fundamental problems in humanitarian intervention. Cost billions and yet don't leave capable states in their wake. Joining us this hour, Ashraf Ghani, who played a central role in the design and implementation of the post-Taliban settlement in Afghanistan, serving as UN advisor to the bond process and as finance minister during Afghanistan's transitional administration. He has worked at the World Bank, taught at Johns Hopkins and Berkeley universities. He has been nominated for the job of Secretary General of the United Nations and considered for the job of President of the World Bank. He chairs the Institute for State Effectiveness. And we welcome you, Ashraf Ghani, to the program today. Hello. Thanks very much.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having us.
Also, Claire Lockhart is director for the Institute for State Effectiveness. She has worked for the World Bank, the United Nations, and advised the government of Afghanistan in Kabul on its strategy and programs from 2002 to 2005. She advises countries and international organizations on state building and has written widely on the topic. Claire Lockhart, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
One of the astounding things about your figures is that there are so many nations, 40 to 60 nations, you write early in the book, home to over a billion people that have collapsed or are teetering on the brink of failure. I don't think that is front and center in any kind of international discussion, is it?
There is an acknowledgement increasingly, and this is reflected, for instance, in UN peacekeeping missions, which have mushroomed since 1990. And there is a lot of lateral discussion, but because the international system is divided into stovepipes, one side discusses it from the perspective of poverty, another side discusses it from the issue of politics, another side discusses it from the question of security. A forum where all of these could be coherently brought together and we fashion a systematic approach to these has yet not taken place.
Mm-hmm. And why is that, Claire? Is it because we're just clinging to models from the past?
Absolutely. One of the things we argue in the book is that we have now 21st century problems and challenges, but we still have 20th century institutions. A lot of the organizations that we rely on were designed just after the Second World War and in the years after that. And they were designed when the world was a very different place. Not only polities were defined in national terms, but the economy was nationally bounded, and civil society as well. There were just a handful of NGOs registered at the UN in those years. Now there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, across the world. So we now have a globalized world, yet organizations that haven't kept up with the changing realities.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Afghanistan for a moment, because both of you were participants in the new government of Afghanistan. There was great hope for what might happen there, and yet now we see the heroin trade is way up. There is more violence. There is more resurgence of the Taliban. And yet you write, and I think most of us don't know this, that Afghanistan is rich in jewels and rich in so many other things. Why is it hard for Afghanistan to move beyond being what we could probably call a failed state?
The following. First, the knowledge base to to actually design an approach that connects it to the process of globalization. And the major failure here has been that of the international partners. A lot of the money that was allocated for Afghanistan was either used through UN agencies or to NGOs and did not connect to an approach that would utilize the potential of the country for connecting it. Second, very little investment has taken place in human capabilities. For instance, the universities have been starved of funds, while hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, have gone to hire foreign advisors who stay from durations of 3 weeks to a year without creating the institutional capabilities. And third is, because it was framed in terms of war, enormous initial allocations were made for military expenditure, but not for an economic developmental strategy that would harness the potential of the youth. 65% of the country is under 25.
Oh, my.
And yet we've ignored to turn those people into stakeholders.
Mm-hmm. What are those foreign advisors who are getting paid a lot of money and not doing anything do all day?
They do a range of things, and some of them can be very, very useful. But one of the examples we look to, Singapore, the leader of Singapore who transformed the country relied on just one advisor who used to come visit every few months. So one of the things we think is that you don't need quite so many tens of thousands of people. What do? They do a range of things, supposedly advising on how to do certain things, on technical matters. Some of them actually, instead of advising Afghans on how to do things, actually start doing the jobs themselves, and that's one of the problems. When technical assistance works properly, the incentives are created that they actually find ways to hand over the knowledge they have and support other personnel to do their jobs rather than stepping in and taking over.
Mm-hmm.
And here there's a lot of duplication. For instance, the realm of rule of law, there are 65 separate programs. So a lot of their time is spent coordinating with each other.
Right. That's a lot of programs. Tell me more about harnessing the enthusiasm and the dedication, the idealism of the 65% of the country that is young. What's to be done with that population?
I'll give you an example. When I went to take over Kabul University, the university was in total crisis. It had no security. There was a lot of fighting, etc. What I arrived at was a concept called shared governance. So I engaged the students in a discussion for 3 months and said, let's arrive at 5 priorities. And the participation in the set of ideas that they came with were unbelievable.
Hmm.
What we discovered, for instance, when I talked to the School of Islamic Law that was supposed to be the hotbed of Islamic radicalism, you know what were their 2 requests as top priorities?
Hmm.
Obligatory English classes and obligatory computer science classes.
Oh, my.
For instance, all the people at Kabul University, at that time it was 9,000, wanted classes in English. We could secure only one person courtesy of British Council. Despite thousands of advisors being present, I could not get people to volunteer to come to teach English classes. These individuals at the university were using their last pennies to take private English classes or to acquire computer skills.
Mm-hmm.
So the two issues with the youth are really important.
Mm-hmm.
One is to give them the capabilities to function in a market. And that requires technical skills that would make them competitive. And second is to give them the sense of rights and obligations as citizens, that they need to feel secure that they are citizens of a functioning country and that the world is a partner and not an opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real myth, I think, in some quarters. People say Afghans have no capacity, therefore we have to hire all this technical assistance from outside. What I've observed is that Afghans have incredible capabilities. I had the honor to go to Peshawar to meet a number of the leaders of the Afghan NGO community at the end of 2001 and found enormous capability for leadership and management amongst the community who really stayed with the country through the years of war to run health and education systems. And we see that in the young people today. If you drive around Kabul at night, you see a lot of lights on in the streets, and it's all the courses that are being run in Microsoft and computer classes. These young people have an enormous hunger for learning and a hatred of corruption. And it's not only the young men, it's the women as well. Dr. Ghani, when he was Minister of Finance, recruited a number of women through a competitive process to be directors of, even director of treasury and director of budget. Mm-hmm. And they were incredibly capable.
Mm-hmm. So is there a state system in place that can put that plan forward, or is there a lack of just human beings and state planning to harness all those people to fill out their dreams and help the country?
The problem is corruption.
Mm.
In the short-term view of preferring personal interest over public interest.
Mm-hmm.
And countries where governments suffer from corruption cannot harness the energies of their people. Instead of moving forward and creating momentum, they slide backwards. So it is not, as Ms. Lockhart was saying, it's not the absence of capacity, but creating the type of design approach that one trusts people with making decisions.
Mm-hmm. So how do you get rid of corruption?
You get rid of corruption through a systemic approach, first that cleans the top of the government, and then systematically change the process of interaction. I'll give you an example. When I became finance minister, I counted in my first week that in order to pay $1 in taxes, an Afghan citizen needed to pay $8 in bribes and waste 1 week of their life.
Hmm.
By the time I got done with customs, before that, they required 24 pages of documents, 20 signatures, an enormous series of running around where they were shaken.
Hmm.
As a result of the change in process and re-engineering the process, the document was reduced to one page, signatures to four. Trucks were told in the custom house that 200 would be processed a day, and the numbering was introduced very systematically, and there was no interaction, physical interaction, paper flow. And we were able to substantially reduce corruption in a fairly limited number of time. Similarly with other reforms that I carried out, so it is possible to go from general notions to very specific ways of designing processes of interaction and making it certain. For
mm-hmm.
instance, the payroll system will lend itself to a lot of corruption till you create an automatic deposit mechanism where the salaries of people are deposited in their account. Then that removes an enormous amount of out of corruption. So modern technology and capabilities of design in working with people to solve solutions give a signal. But then it has to start from the top and go for the massive items of corruption first rather than petty items on which a lot of time could be wasted. Petty corruption is a product of big corruption, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. So is it the leadership of the government? It's obviously not the foreign advisors who we've had disparaging words to say about it in the past few minutes. Who's to accomplish this task?
It requires a partnership from both sides in Afghanistan. Also, the number of other countries that we've observed, both the successful cases and the ones where challenges still exist. What we argue is that there's currently a double failure of both the international community and many government leaderships.
Mm-hmm.
And what's required instead is a what we call a double compact. It requires a real partnership between the international community who cohere around an overarching plan or vision and the leadership of the country and the citizens. That's why we call it a double compact. Many agreements and conditionalities are often just between the government and the international community, forgetting that the really important compact is that between a government and its citizens.
Mm-hmm. We'll go back to Afghanistan in a moment. You mentioned successful countries. What are some examples that you cite in your book of failed states that have been fixed, and how has that been accomplished?
Well, first is Europe after World War II. You know, Europe in 47, 48, faced the specter of famine, massive riots, German currency had become worthless, there, the imagination of wise people, wise men and women, the generation that have been called here, that devised the Marshall Plan, mm-hmm. and those that created first the community of steel and coal, and that eventually has become the European Union, it's been a phenomenal transformation.
Hmm.
Second is Singapore. It went from a poor, corrupt, marginal island to an economic powerhouse. Third is Southern Europe, which is Spain, Portugal. Then Ireland, again, a remarkable example of transformation. And another example that is much closer in the United States, of course, are the southern states of the United States after the Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
Georgia, if today it were an independent country, would be the 17th largest economy in the world.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
Atlanta, and that was a marginal city, now is the site of 100 Fortune 500 companies.
Mm-hmm.
Southern Carolina has become one of the most attractive destinations for foreign investment because the educational system has been geared towards producing type of capabilities that have been remarkable. Or North Carolina is judged top in terms of business friendliness. And the research triangle is an example of how human capital and ingenuity has been harnessed that people would have dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
So the Old South, that would have been reduced to the notion of cotton and tobacco, has undergone a remarkable transformation in the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm. But we're not looking at, when we examine all of these places that you just mentioned, we're not looking at a one solution for all. We need to look at the individual countries and examine what their own problems are. There's no one-size-fits-all.
Absolutely. And what we're proposing, and we put forward a framework for state building, but what we're proposing is this isn't a cookie cutter that's applied regardless to country conditions. Rather reverse. We're arguing that you need a much more nuanced approach to reading the country context, reading what's on the ground. In preparing this book, we spent time not only in Afghanistan, but our colleagues and us spent a number of months in different countries. We spent time in southern Sudan, in Nepal, Lebanon, Kosovo, for example, really listening to stakeholder groups, convening groups of women, university professors, editors of newspapers, businessmen, officials in the government in groups and listening to how they saw their country. And it's amazing how quickly it was possible to build up a picture of what the context really was about and the enormous assets that exist in the countries. Often we read in donor reports there's nothing there or there's a blank slate or a tabula rasa. But of course, when you go to the countries and you talk to people, there's enormous capabilities, mostly in the human capital, but also in the natural assets of a country and the potential for wealth generation, it's possible to find almost anywhere.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests, the authors of Fixing Failed States, A Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World, which has just been published by Oxford University Press. Our guests are Claire Lockhart, director of the Institute for State Effectiveness. She's worked for the World Bank, the United Nations, and advised the government of Afghanistan in Kabul on its strategy and programs from 2002 to 2005. She advises countries and international organizations on state building. Also joining us is Ashraf Ghani, who played a central role in the design and implementation of the post-Taliban settlement in Afghanistan, served as a UN advisor to the bond process and as finance minister during Afghanistan's transitional administration. He has worked at the World Bank and taught at a number of universities in Kabul and in the United States. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. for you to join our conversation, or you can send an email if you'd like, and that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight, as you know, there are primaries today in Kentucky and Oregon, and tonight from 9 o'clock until 11, you're invited to tune in for NPR special coverage of presidential primaries in those states. NPR's Don Gagne and David Green will be hosting this election special heard on the Ideas Network, and then be sure and tune in tomorrow morning and afternoon to hear more analysis on the morning show with Jean Purcell, who's in for Joy Cardine. My show tomorrow, we'll be talking about it, and Ben Marins, and then the 1 o'clock hour of Talk of the Nation will also be an election special, so stay tuned for that. We go to your phone calls and to your emails now as we speak with the author of Fixing Failed States, A Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World. 800-486-8655 is our number. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Or again, that email address, which is, if you can't use the phone, maybe you do have access to a computer and can send an email, and that's at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And we start our calls with Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Fine guests. Would I be able to perhaps make 2 points, and then there are actually questions? And I'm referring to Afghanistan specifically, but it's a general problem of state building, in that Afghanistan, for the second time after the defeat of the Taliban, was left without any support. The ability to pick itself up was virtually non-existent, and it fell both after the defeat of the Russians and the second defeat of the Taliban into lawlessness because the central authorities were not strong enough. We made no attempt to help them as we did Europe after the Second War. And the second observation is that Afghanistan was a great and prosperous nation when the Silk Route was a chief trading route. And could that ever happen again if the region was stabilized? Mm. So thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Want to start with that, Ashraf Ghani?
Certainly. First comment is, of course, that in the 1990s, Afghanistan was a neglected crisis. And that lack of attention to having supported and armed a group of people and then abandoned them to a civil war resulted in the hijacking of Afghanistan by Al-Qaeda and, of course, the tragedy of 9/11. After the emergence of the new government, initially, the degree of support and investment was slow. So one of my tasks was really to persuade the world to put a greater commitment of resources. And that has happened now, but it took a lot of time, so we lost the window of opportunity. Second, revival of the Silk Road is absolutely critical. What my colleagues and I came with was the notion of a land bridge. Key to the future prosperity of Afghanistan is to be seen as a connection between Central Asia, South Asia, and the Gulf. Hmm. And that requires a regional approach to building of infrastructure, to cooperating on energy, to cooperating on electricity, on water. There's an enormous range of possibilities that can result in creation of mutual benefits both for Afghanistan, for the region, and for stability for the world.
Do you want to comment as well, Claire?
Absolutely. Commenting just on the last few years, just to illustrate Dr. Ghani's comments further, and very much in line with the caller's comments, I think we collectively really underestimated the resources and commitment that building a state would take, but not necessarily money. As we've been discussing, there's enormous wealth in the country already. It's finding the right approach to unleash that wealth. But it did require early investment to kickstart the process. And one of the mistakes that was made was that back in 2002, because many of the donors didn't understand how to approach state building. They thought it was, they really treated Afghanistan like a run-of-the-mill humanitarian crisis. So there was only $20 million put to paying the 260,000 civil servants who were in place, roughly that number. And this was doctors and teachers and policemen. $20 million for a year hardly pays a fuel bill for a month. And if you contrast it to the budget even of a city in the US or Europe, it's a tiny amount. And by contrast, around $2 billion was immediately put into a system of UN agencies and NGOs, many of which do great work, but are very expensive ways of delivering benefits to the people. It's the state that must be resurrected to provide those services. So I think that these misjudgments have really compounded the problem. It wasn't the lack of generosity in money, but it was the way that the money was spent, which has resulted in some of the problems we see today.
Yeah. Why is it that this figure is stuck in my mind ever since we had this wonderful guest a few weeks ago talking about Afghanistan, who grew up in the country, and I don't know if you agree with this, but you talk about in the book the heroin production, and you talk about the other riches in Afghanistan. Why is it that heroin production has tripled since we went into Afghanistan, and why aren't some of those other riches that the country has used as a source for making money? Why is it heroin?
Because heroin is the ugly side of globalization.
Mm.
There, it's a cartel both globally and locally in Afghanistan that is coordinating perfectly. For instance, heroin dealers have a system of credit to the producers. They've bought off the entire law and order component, whether it's the Ministry of Interior or the court system, so they cannot be prosecuted. Their supply chains are state-of-the-art. Their capability for processing. They pay chemists. For instance, 90 chemists that are at the core of this are among the highest people in the country. Delivery in Europe takes place through shipments to West Africa and then from variety in Central Asia and Russia and others. So they've worked out the mechanisms to perfection. By contrast, the international aid system is incredibly slow in response. One of the first things I asked, for instance, was design of an agricultural strategy that we could get our crops, our key crops, for instance. There are a lot of herbs that could be critical to giving alternatives. USAID, that is the international agency for assistance, could never materialize the knowledge and connections to bring the five key corporations that are central to production of spices and herbs as a global marketing strategy together. So that's one aspect. Second was, because a number of people had participated with the United States in the ousting of the Taliban, they were tolerated and given immunity, in effect. And the NATO forces decided to stay away from eradication of drugs. They thought it was too dangerous. So if you combine it, first there was not an economic coherent strategy to support and offer real alternatives. They were falling back on what are called alternative livelihoods that have not really worked out. You know, to offer alternatives to opium, one has to create the basis of a legal economy that can, within 5 to 10 years, produce $1,000 income per capita. And that has not been approached.
Let's go next to Mike from La Crosse. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. I guess I'm not quite sure how to frame my question, but I was wondering what your guests thought about the Democratic Republic of the Congo in terms of how China is investing there and how the, I don't know, the other companies like the gold companies and the diamond companies are working there also. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
All right.
Extractive industries have been a key problem in terms of their support either for dictatorial regimes or their lack of transparency. So the issue of extractive industries cannot be reduced now to the investment of China. at the heart of crisis in Iran, for instance, in Iran's relationship with the United States, is the role of the oil company in Iran, and for whose protection an elected government in 1953 was ousted through a coup d'etat, and it has become the black mark in the Iranian consciousness. On the positive side now, there's a major initiative called Transparency in Extractive Industries. This means that all the companies that are involved in mining, oil, or others would actually disclose what they're paying the government. This is a major step forward in terms that if we can secure this agreement, it becomes the basis of the use of resources for productive purposes. And for the Democratic Republic of Congo is a fragmented country that needs to be put together, and it requires enormous attention. So protecting the natural wealth of the country is critical to its future prosperity because it's one of the richest places on earth. But the governance arrangements that are necessary for that yet have to be put in place.
Mm-hmm. And we argue that it's not just the extractive industries, but in a lot of countries, it's a range of other resources, from the way water is used, the way land and forests are used. And it's quite extraordinary, whereas companies have to release their balance sheets, not just the cash flow, but actually their balance sheets every year. States don't actually have this common practice or obligation. So we're arguing that, like companies, states must report on how they're using their assets, how they're licensing them, how they're selling them, and how they're making maximum use of them for the citizens of the country. And if we had such an accounting framework in place and developed conventions and practices for such reports, we'd be able to begin to move towards a regime of transparency.
Mm-hmm. Claire Lockhart, have we seen an increase in the number of failed states since World War II, or are there fewer?
That's an excellent question. One of the difficulties in answering it, and one of the reasons we wrote the book, is that there isn't actually a standard agreed way of judging the answer.
Hmm.
There isn't currently a global index which has buy-in to judge how many, by what criteria, a state is judged to fail or succeed, and whether states are declining or improving in their capability along a continuum. There has been a proliferation of indices, but they tend to measure just one aspect, maybe human development or transparency or another aspect of governance. What we're proposing is that in the book is that we need a framework and a common agreement on how we measure what are the responsibilities of states to their citizens in the 21st century. We propose that there are 10 functions, but this isn't meant to be a definitive answer. It's really to open a public discussion and contribute to a public discussion. We're proposing that if there was such agreement, we could actually create what we're proposing should be a sovereignty or state effectiveness index, and issued on an annual basis, perhaps at the UN and World Bank annual meetings, so that attention could be drawn to which countries are improving, which ones are declining, where future problems might be. The indices that do exist would put the current number at around 40 to 60, but we don't yet have the definitive answer.
Mm-hmm. And do you sense that there's great interest in doing that? Has your book stirred up a lot of interest?
We found, absolutely, and we've just had the privilege to have a number of public discussions in many parts of the United States, and have found enormous engagement, wonderful questions, and great suggestions for moving forward. We've started to build out the index and are piloting it in a number of countries, and they're coming up with some very interesting results. The UN and the World Bank actually convened a conference for us a couple of years back, and in near New York in the Greentree Estates, where they convened 12 leaders of post-conflict transitions, and these leaders met and examined the framework. They said they wanted to add two more functions. They were very concerned about transitional justice and the ability of states to manage disaster, to provide disaster relief themselves. And we really see this issue at the moment in both China and Myanmar playing out. Do the states, should they rely on external aid, or should they be acquire the capabilities and have the both the right and the responsibility and the capabilities to respond? And this was deemed very important by these 12 leaders of post-conflict transition. So, and these leaders said that if they had such a map of these functions and ability to measure, this would have been an enormous help to them as they faced their own transition. So high interest from both the people managing transitions and from many organizations and citizens in seeing such a system put in place.
Let's go to Mark from Whitewater next. Hello, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thanks very much for the topic. I'm finding it very interesting. My question for your two commenters is, I was very heartened by the example that was given about concrete things that were done in, I believe, Afghanistan to thwart corruption, the reducing the number of forms and signatures and things like that. And that just made me feel very hopeful that things can get better. But central to that working is requires a will from the top. And what I'm wondering about is, how can these models be applied to the situation in Iraq? In particular, you know, the so-called surge has quelled violence and given the Iraqi government the opportunity to do things. And at least from the news reports we get in the United States, not much has happened. And so one can draw the conclusion that in fact, those leaders lack the will. Perhaps that's not true, and I'd actually like to hear what your two commenters have to say.
Okay, thank you for your call.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. I think there were many examples of where Afghanistan, and it was the customs reform that Dr. Ghani described, but there were a whole raft of other reforms that he and his colleagues led in Afghanistan that really give cause for hope. I'll give you another couple of examples of where these reforms really helped to tackle corruption on a systemic basis. One was the Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund. A trust fund was created where donors could put their money in, and then the government could use it for key activities, including paying doctors and teachers until the revenue system enabled them to pay for it themselves. But the government could only draw on that money after audit reports had come in showing that expenditure was satisfactory, and then they could withdraw the money on a reimbursable basis, so providing donors full assurance that their money had already been properly spent. Another example is something we call national programs. And one was a ring road around the country, both helping to reinforce national unity, but also position Afghanistan as a land bridge in the region. Another example, a health system. So instead of NGOs coming and doing their own thing and putting a clinic here or there, but then not, there aren't doctors to put in it, contracting out services across the country according to agreed-upon level of service provision. And this has proved very effective. Finally, and perhaps one of the most vivid examples of how a national program can be effective, from the trust fund I mentioned, a block grant given to every village in the country, it's nearly fully implemented. 32,000 villages have been covered out of the 40,000. Villages can access the money if they do three things. They must elect their village council. A quorum of the village must come together to choose their project, not just the council. And then they must put accounts up in a public place. This means that the Afghan citizens do the heavy lifting. So you don't require so many contractors and foreigners all around the country doing the work, and it provides the citizens ownership in the process and the ability to do the jobs to make it all work. When we've observed this program, one of the things that's really remarkable is it's not only a very efficient way to spend money. Sometimes the projects are implemented at about a quarter or a fifth of the price it would cost to implement it through the aid system. But it also helps to reinforce good governance. And one woman said, you know, it makes me feel like a citizen. We get to make the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of model. Now, these are very much tailored to context and designed for a specific moment in time and place. But we're finding that these kind of models would have application to a lot of different countries. We've been working at a team at the Institute to assist leaders think about how they could design similar approaches in places ranging from Kosovo to Nepal to southern Sudan. And you asked specifically how can the models be applied to Iraq, that the so-called surge has been a military one, but there hasn't been an economic surge. And one of the things we propose is two aspects will be terribly important. One is what we call national accountability systems. How is the public finance of the country managed and spent? How does the accountability system work as a system? You know, how do the different pieces fit together? The treasury, budget, procurement, accounting, auditing. You know, all these things are very boring to diplomats sometimes. They think accountancy is a backroom function, but it's really the key to accountability and good governance. So the first recommendation from Iraq will be to look at that. One of the things that we spotted is that Iraq has actually been unable to spend even its own budget. It wrote down its capital expenditure from $10 billion to $4 billion because it can't spend it, because it hasn't got the system working. So that's really the key. Then the second is how to use these types of programs. The one I just cited is specifically for rural areas, but in Iraq, something designed for the urban areas might be really key to create large amounts of jobs and address the housing shortage. There are 1.5 million housing units in shortage.
Oh, my.
So designing a system that procured the funding in a transparent way, reinforced the construction industry that gave people not only construction jobs, but management jobs and an ownership, a stake in the system, while creating housing units for people, could be one example of how this approach could be applied.
We're going to welcome more phone calls in just one moment. We're speaking with the authors of Fixing Failed States, A Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World. Claire Lockhart is director of the Institute for State Effectiveness. She's worked at the Bank, World Bank, and the UN. She is trained as a barrister, and she helped write the Bonn Agreement that formed the Afghan government. During her years in Kabul, she played a key leadership role in developing the national program's approach to Afghanistan's reconstruction efforts. Ashraf Ghani is also with us. He has taught at a number of universities, Johns Hopkins, Berkeley, and Kabul University, worked at the World Bank, served as finance minister of Afghanistan, and has been credited with a range of successful reforms in that country following 9/11. We have a couple lines open. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There are primaries today in, as you recall, Kentucky and Oregon, and there will be a special tonight on NPR from 9 p.m. until 11. You're invited to tune in for special coverage of the presidential primaries in Kentucky and Oregon. NPR's Don Gagne and David Green will host this election special heard on these Ideas Network stations. And then be sure and tune in tomorrow morning. We'll give you a chance to react in full measure. Jean Purcell, who's in for Joy Cardine, will be having a program. We will have a really good show tomorrow. Barbara Walters will be with us at 9 o'clock on her new book, Audition. And then after 9:30, Air America radio host and MSNBC political commentator will be up until the wee hours of this morning, will join us to discuss the Kentucky and Oregon primaries. And after 10 tomorrow, we'll look at gender and women in politics. And that should be a good program as well. We've heard a lot about race in this presidential election, but not as much about gender. Our guests right now until the top of the hour are authors of Fixing Failed States, A Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World. And we go to Bill from Oshkosh next. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I'm concerned about looking at things maybe from the bottom up more. You've mentioned villages and other things. You've mentioned institutional problems at the top level of government. And they're very much concerned with me about what I've seen in Papua New Guinea, which is with the Solomons, and Bougainville has had other problems of government, particularly around extractive resources and fights about who gets control of those. However, I've seen just this last February at the local level where the tribal system, the so-called, is still very much intact, but it's reached into the government in a sense of political kinds of payoffs and connections. But there are no institutions to insist on fair play or open accounting, or as you suggested, the companies that extract resources from the country do not have open book relationships and money. I mean, it's well known to people at the bottom in the rural area that this money is going astray, both from royalty payments and development agencies or NGOs. and they're very upset about it. But, you know, to me, just saying, well, we need to impose the state down to the, quote, village level, unquote, which doesn't apply really in a lot of these areas. I mean, they're not villages per se. And, you know, to turn everybody into a peasant or, you know, single households, you know, looking after themselves and their little village is not really a model that's going to work as well as the one that's there already, in which people do by being member of a tribal system or a lineage, like in parts of Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia. You know, people are able to look after their own land, have a form of local government and means of redressing disputes, etc. And in this case, on top of it, the police have been largely ineffective, whereas the Australian, the colonial administrators, at least to my eyes, kept things quite peaceful and very even-handedly and were not so corruptible. Anyway, I'd like your opinion on what to do with all these situations where tribal governments play a very important role or tribal institutions, rather, play a very important role in local governments and social life.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for your excellent question. Ashraf Ghani?
Yes, thank you. First, we have not proposed any top-down model of imposition on villages where they're turned into individual households. The mechanisms have just been the opposite for national solidarity, where people who have a compound in common or an area in compound actually get together and elect their leaders. This may coincide with a lineage, it may coincide with a clan, or it may coincide with another form of identity, or may not. The critical issue is that they be able to choose their form of social organization with which they are comfortable, and then they are given decision rights over a set of resources. What has not happened in Papua New Guinea, as our commentator clearly indicated, is a mechanism of working between the government in these lineages or inhabitants of rural areas. And two issues become important to that. One, there's rent from extractive industries, and that needs to become transparent at the center. And two, a system of allocation so it can be channeled proper way. In three, on the ground, a mechanism that they can make decision rights. This is at the core of our argument. And New Guinea, and particularly the separation of Bougainville, that's a separatist attempt, shows that when you don't get this right, and when the central government is not the mechanism of fair play and justice, a lot of trouble and rebellion, separatist movements, and others occur.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to amplify that at all, Claire?
I think absolutely, and it's a great question. In general, what we're arguing is that not any, for any particular structure that's imposed from outside, but that citizens, it was just our observation from discussions with citizens across the world, that today citizens expect their state to perform a range of functions, the most critical of which, as the caller identified, is transparency and accountability and management of public resources. And we're not arguing that that should be very centralized or very decentralized, but the right way for the particular context is found to ensure that those functions are performed in the right way for the context. One of the examples that's emerged over the last years is the way that the European Union has managed to allocate those functions to the right levels of governance. And a principle they use is something called subsidiarity, where the principle is that the decision should be taken as close to the citizen as possible. But that doesn't mean that everything should be decentralized. And in places across the world that are currently facing enormous challenges of governance, one of the critical questions is, at what level of government should the function be performed? And in many countries, there are lots of different levels, ranging from the village, the district, the province, the center, the township, in some cases, other configurations. So it's coming up with the right design, building on the assets and the practices that are there to bring good governance.
Mm-hmm. One area we haven't talked about, and we only have about a minute left here, what about the groups in these failed states that are involved with terrorism, criminality, arms and narcotics thrive, fester in areas of misrule? How do you address these problems in failed states?
The critical issue here is a vision of the future that the ordinary people and a significant number of people who are not involved in these criminal activities can rally to.
Mm-hmm.
And then a plan of action that is credible and is implemented with rigor, and that requires a rule of law approach. That law should define use of force against these criminal elements and be rigorous in application. Because today it's an attitude of either accommodation with them or fear from them or then random attempts. Unless it becomes the lesson of counterinsurgencies from places like Malaya and Singapore and others that were successful was that you need a coherent approach that is systematically followed, because at the heart of all these is winning the loyalty of the ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
And that cannot be done without the government itself becoming credible and having the accountability and the trust in their leadership and judgment so that people can rally to them.
Yeah. Thank you both very much for the important book and thoughts. The book is Fixing Failed States, A Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World. It is published by Oxford University Press, and the writers are Ashraf Ghani and Claire Lockhart, who were both very involved in the early stages of fashioning a government in Afghanistan. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program and to John Treader for on-air production here in Milwaukee. We'll be with you tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.